From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Adoption in this country is changing. In fact, Adam Pertman calls it a revolution. Not so long ago, adoption was whispered about. It was one of those family secrets. There were stigmas and myths and pressure to keep your mouth shut. But Pertman says these days adoption is like the energy of a volcano. After years of warning tremors, change has erupted. Adoption, he says, is reshaping itself to the core. Cultural taboos are being set aside. Laws are being rewritten. Technology is making it simpler for adoptees and birth parents to find each other, for single women and multiracial families and same-sex couples to be parents. Today in the program, we're talking about adoption. Adam Pertman will join us. We hope you will, too, with your own stories and questions after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So let me just say at the outset here, as a matter of full disclosure, I was adopted. It's one of those kids who pretty much always knew it. My parents didn't sit me down one day, for example, and make some delicate pronouncement. So there wasn't a lot of whispering going on, not in my family anyway. But my experience was pretty typical in the sense that there were a lot of taboos in those days and stigmas, and the process was mostly closed. But things have changed. So much so that Adam Pertman calls it a revolution. Pertman is a journalist who's been writing about adoption for years now. His work on the subject for the Boston Globe earned him a Pulitzer nomination. And he says adoption in this country is reshaping itself. And in the process, it's reshaping American culture. These days, the stigma is being put aside. Laws are being rewritten. It's not always easy, but adoption is becoming an option for single women and same-sex couples and multiracial families. And technology is making it easier for adoptees and birth parents to find each other. Today in the program, we're talking about adoption. Adam Pertman is our guest, and we're hoping that you'll join us as well with your own questions or stories. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Adam Pertman is executive director of the Donaldson Adoption Institute. It's a research, policy, and education organization. He's the author of Adoption Nation and co-editor of Adoption by Lesbians and Gay Men. And he's joining us from a studio in Boston. And Adam Pertman, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So I guess let me ask, I know this seems like a strange question, but I wanted you to begin by describing or explaining what you mean by I guess the question is, what is adoption, which seems obvious, but you describe it as being a marvel of humanity and a social safety valve. Could you just explain that?
Sure. In most cultures in the world, families are all about blood.
Yeah.
And that's what they're supposed to be. That's how they think of themselves. That's how they, you know, they believe that procreation is all. And that's how the world has functioned. Now, with one big caveat, you know, Moses was adopted. Superman was adopted. Adoption pervades every country's culture in some way. It wasn't formal adoption. And that's where we get to us as the adoption nation and this marvel. And lots of other countries adopt children, but Americans adopt more children than the rest of the world combined. So we really are that adoption nation. And the marvel is that we have transcended that understanding in a real formal way. We have transcended that understanding of family as being solely about procreating, making your own babies, having your own blood, having children who look like you, to understanding that there is that there can be an institution that serves the interests of children, children who need homes. And now, today, we see more and more of that from foster care. For roughly a generation, we saw it from other countries. That's slowing down. But institutionally, in this country, we created that marvel. We embraced that marvel with lots of stigma, lots of shame, lots of caveats. But that is what we did. We created a whole different alternative to what a family is, what it looks like, how it functions. And that's, you know, I think it's wonderful on many levels and complicated on every single one of them.
Right.
But most of all, it is wonderful for children who need families, children who need homes, because if we didn't transcend it, then they would remain second-class citizens or be remain institutionalized, which is certainly true in lots of countries, and it and they don't have permanency in many cases in foster care.
Yeah.
But we do have an institution that is that safety valve for all parties concerned, and that in the end serves the interests of children who need families. That's a good thing.
When you first came to this issue, what did you know about it?
I write in my book that in Adoption Nation that I knew less than nothing.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because most of what I thought I knew, and we can talk, this will be probably the subject of a good bit of the conversation today, most of what I thought I knew was skewed or mistaken or just wrong.
Yeah.
And the umbrella, the factor, the reason is that for whatever good it does and for all of its complexity or for whatever negatives it might have, adoption was underground for our lifetimes,
yeah.
for generations. We didn't talk about it. People didn't tell their own children they were adopted. Women who placed children for adoption or lost their kids to adoption were shamed underground. They're terribly stigmatized, and they remain the most stigmatized parties in adoption. And, you know, we felt sorry for everybody,
yeah.
right? Adoptive parents, I'm sorry, you couldn't have any real children. Women who were having children out of wedlock, which is where most babies came from, not today,
yeah.
but in the past, we drove them underground and we shamed them. And we called adopted people, those babies, bastards and illegitimate. Nice way to talk about kids, I think.
Yeah.
So we had our distinct negatives. But the revolution, you know, that I write about, the belief that I have is that we're moving away from that. We're progressing ahead of that. And I think not shaming, not stigmatizing, not undermining are probably good things to happen to children and families.
The first comprehensive study about adoption was released in 1997. What did that tell us about this adoption nation?
It was not so much a study as a survey.
Survey,
I mean,
right.
That is research, certainly. And it was done by the organization I now head, but I did not at the time. And it was a survey of Americans' attitudes regarding adoption. And is for anybody who's interested, the name of the organization, as you said, is the Donaldson Adoption Institute. We're sort of the leading think tank in the field. And the website is adoptioninstitute.org. And much of what we talk about today is the subject of material that's on that website.
We'll put a link in our website as well. Yeah.
Great. What we try to measure back then, and we've done a couple of subsequent measures, is what do people know about adoption and how do they feel about it? And the answer was they don't know. We didn't know a whole lot. And
yeah.
This goes back to your last question to me. I knew certainly less than nothing because, you know, you don't do good research on secrets. You don't learn about secrets. We didn't tell our own kids. So I came into it not knowing a lot. And a lot of what we learned from the survey work we've done is that people don't know as much as we wish they would. And, you know, that has real consequences when people don't understand anything, but certainly when they don't understand a big, significant part of our population and how it functions. And so we learned that, but we also learned very interesting things. We learned, I mean, all of it was interesting, don't get me wrong. But we also learned that people have a very positive view of adoption, overwhelmingly in high numbers, and that's a good thing. We learned that 6 out of 10, and I actually think it's higher,
yeah.
and we can talk about that if you want, 6 out of 10 Americans have a direct connection to adoption. So we're talking about an institution that touches most people's lives. And again, I think it's higher than 6 in 10.
Yeah.
And we learned that. And we learned a lot of other things that weren't so great to hear. I don't remember the numbers anymore, but a big minority of Americans think that adopted children and their parents don't love each other as much as the parents and children in biologically formed families.
Mm-hmm.
That's not so hot. Yeah. And it's also not true.
Yeah.
But those sort of stigmatizing, second-class, second-rate kind of understandings of adoption are, I think, the consequence of all those generations of secrecy. You know, we keep secrets about things we're ashamed of and embarrassed about.
Yeah.
So as a nation, we drove this institution underground. And that must have meant that it had something to hide, right? That something was amiss. And so this coming out, if you will, is a very positive thing. You know, we'll see the warts and all, but it's a much better place to be.
I want to come back to that that issue, what we know and how things are changing. I also want to talk a little bit more about sort of the time when all of this was taboo, because you write about this in your book. Let's talk about Sheila Hansen. It's a woman you met in New Jersey, and you write about how, in 1961, she was this government clerk in Louisiana. She was unmarried, pretty young, and she gets pregnant. And it seems like Sheila's story is reflective of the attitude of the time, and I wanted to talk about some of that because it seems to tell us how we used to think about adoption. I mean, a couple of the things. For example, you mentioned she was given this advice that, you know, you can't give the child a proper home. You know, all of this would ruin your life. You know, that having an illegitimate child would scar her for life. The child would be scarred for life. The shame of the condition. This was interesting, too. You talk about that a lot of these young women, Sheila included, she was heavily sedated for the delivery to kind of insulate her from the experience of having a baby.
Right.
Talk about that.
Well, I want to say up front, you know, this was the time in which people lived. I'm not pointing fingers at anyone. I'm relaying a piece of history.
Yeah.
And we know, those of us who are, you know, a little older, that the stigma against unwed motherhood was profound in this country and others. Yeah. I'm not, again, not pointing fingers at this country. It was profound. Today, that has largely lifted, and it's part one of the biggest reasons for the change in adoption, actually. Because back in Sheila's day, you know, when she gave birth, and yes, many women were sedated or lied to, or lots of stuff happened. And most of it, not all of it by any means, but most of it, you know, with good intentions. Let's protect her. Let's protect the baby.
Yeah.
Let's protect everybody. You know, what happened as a consequence was that women like Sheila went into therapy for the next 30 years. You know, it turns out that you can't give up your baby and forget about it and move on as though you'd given away an old record player. But society thought maybe that was true and acted accordingly. And so adoption in those days really consisted almost exclusively of white babies born to white unwed mothers adopted by white married couples. And we can talk about what that looks like today, and it gives you a very clear picture of how profoundly adoption has changed and the ways in which it's changing American families. Because back then, the whole idea was you had all these – they had all – this was formal adoption. In communities of color, adoption has always been informal – has historically been informal. Aunt takes care of the baby. The grandmother takes care of the baby. In white culture, that it was shamed. The woman was sent to a home for unwed mothers or put in a hospital, whatever. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, there was no baby. And the baby was in another family somewhere. And what they did try to do was quite literally match newborns to the new parents, the social workers and other professionals, match them so that it would be seamless, so you could hide how you formed your family. If you wouldn't have to be ashamed, you wouldn't have to tell. So we stigmatized it from the get-go. But that was what our world looks like. It looked like at the time. And Sheila was by no means an exception.
You write about adoptees. This question of identity, this quest for identity seems really important. You say most adoptees start coping with these identity issues by the time they're 7 or 8?
You know, by the time they get into elementary school, generally. Yeah. And not everybody perceives that they are looking into their adoptive identity.
Yeah.
They just, you know, kids want to know who they are and where they come from. It's cognitive realization as you start moving from concrete thinking to abstract thinking. You know, it's what family trees assignments are all about. And you look at the curricula in elementary schools, and there's lots of stuff that's about families. Yeah. That's, you know, where did your family come from? Now, that the clarity of just sort of what a bad idea was not to tell your own child where and from whom they came, that clarity really started being stark But it's true for, I think, most kids, if not all, adopted kids. It started being stark when we started moving into the era of transracial adoption, transethnic adoption. You know, then suddenly, you know, and these are true stories. I mean, you know, little girl being told in her classroom, oh, so your grandmother is from Eastern Europe. I know. I know your parents. And this little girl is Chinese. You know, yes, on her adoptive parent's side, this is true. But, you know, if she's going to be able to look in the mirror and understand who she is, there's more to the story.
Are adoptees more difficult to raise is a question that comes up. You say not necessarily, but parents do have to understand that adoptees go through what you call these stages of understanding.
Sure. Well, you know, the way I describe it, I don't think that adopted kids necessarily are more difficult to raise. I think that you have to, as a parent, you want to understand your children and the issues in your family well enough to do the best job that you can.
Right.
So do I think adoption is, and adopted kids, do I think adoption is more complicated than, say, divorced families or step families or single parent families or families where one parent is one religion and another is another religion, or one is a conservative Republican and another is a liberal Democrat? Mm. Nah, probably not more complicated than any of those. But I think as families and as a culture, we have wrapped our heads around those kinds of differences, had a national dialogue, an internal dialogue about what that means to how do we deal with our kids? You know, what does visitation look like? Mm-hmm. 30 years ago, we had a very comparable national dialogue about divorce. Now, nobody's advocating divorce as a positive social institution, but we understand the kids weren't responsible. And we understand that divorce brings in certain dynamics and may have emotional repercussions on the kids and the family. We think about those things and we understand that our family is different. Mm-hmm. Different isn't better or worse. It's just different. And we want to deal with those differences and understand them and address the challenges and make sure that we raise our kids as best we can, understanding what the circumstances are of their lives and of our families. And that's the complexity of it. We just haven't had that real dialogue, that nitty-gritty dialogue relating to adoption because, again, we kept it a secret forever. So how could we have – you don't have dialogues around secrets. Social workers literally told adoptive parents, you just raised your child as though you gave birth to her.
Right.
Well – turns out she was born in Korea and you are a white couple, Mormon couple in Utah. That might have been a hard thing to do, but that's what people did. They literally did, and they raised their children just as if they gave birth to them. It was all about shame and trying to be normal and trying to do things, quote, the right way. Mm-hmm. Well, the right way is different in different families.
Yeah. You know, this question comes up, too, for adoptees who there are those, of course, who choose to seek out their biological mothers or fathers,
and the question, or siblings
for that matter. And the question comes up: why does that matter? Why does biology matter? Or why does seeking out a biological sibling,
sure,
or parent, why does that matter? Do you think, to people?
Well, I think I know that it matters to people, but you know, not being an adopted person, I see it from the outside. But I write about it, and I certainly know thousands. I have no idea at this point, you know, of adopted people, and we've done research on it at the Institute, so we have a pretty good handle on this. Mm-hmm. The easy way to the non-research way to address it that I find easy to wrap my head around. Alex Haley, remember when he wrote Roots and the Hulk in the book and the TV series? All of America in unison was shaking its head up and down. Yeah, everybody wants to know where they are, who they are, and where they come from. That's right. Well, there was no asterisk as said except for adopted people.
Yeah.
You know, we think it is perfectly normal in every other kind of family for, you know, Jews to go back to Israel and Irish people go back to Ireland and to teach your kids, show your kids the family album. Don't you look just like Aunt Mary, you know, who came from Spain, or you name it. You name it. And it is normal, and we think that it's right, and it's a good thing, and genealogical sites are the biggest, I think, are the biggest or second biggest sites, most visited sites on the internet. We think this is fine and good, except for adopted people. Well, where's the logic in that? And there is none. Mm-hmm. There are both normal human reasons for adopted people wanting, and it's certainly not true for everybody,
yeah.
though I think at some level it's true for everybody, some innate curiosity or need to know or desire to know. But, you know, it's normal. I want to see where the woman who gave birth to me, why, what a weird request. It's not a weird request. Now, not everybody wants it, but is it reasonable and sane and human? Of course it is. And sometimes there are more reasons than just that. You might want your medical history. You might just want to see somebody who looks like you. You might be having a baby of your own and want to be able to pass on your genealogy or the knowledge of where your family history is from, or why there's cancer in you as the adoptee in your body, but not in your parents. Where did that come from? Or maybe you have a daughter and want to know whether there's cancer in the family. Well, there's one way to find out. And so the drive, the reality of modern day adoption, it's one of the transformative aspects, is we did some research at the Institute on openness in adoption, what works, what doesn't work,
yeah.
et cetera. And one of the interesting things we discovered, and all of this work is on our website, one of the things we discovered is only 5% of adoption agencies today are closed adoptions. Well, that used to be 100%. It did not move because it was a bad idea, because it served the interests of everyone poorly, because everyone said, I don't want it, but you forced it down my throat. We've moved from the old days to this reality because everyone's interests are better served. And the primary beneficiary of openness, according to the research, and you need research, you know, to show you the sun is shining, but the primary beneficiaries are adopted people because it fills in a piece of their identity. It satisfies their questions even if they didn't ask them, and it gives them the opportunity to learn about themselves. It's not about rejecting the family that raised you, your real parents. It's about knowing all the pieces of your puzzle.
Adam Pertman is with us. He directs the Donaldson Adoption Institute. We'll put a link to their website on ours. His book is called Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming Our Families and America. And we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about adoption. And, of course, there's a lot to talk about. Adopting kids of a different race, for example, or same-sex couples or single people adopting. There's also the issue of identity. We've been talking about that. It wasn't so long ago when adoption was whispered about. It's a family secret. Nowadays, there are open adoptions and different attitudes. Adam Pertman is our guest today. He's written about adoption for years now. His book is called Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming Our Families and America. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So we'll get to just how things have changed, what adoption looks like now in the 21st century. But you also say that many Americans still haven't assimilated some of the changes, and because you say some of them seem, you know, counterintuitive, some of them seem a little disconcerting, and one of those seems to be this idea of open adoptions. Talk about open adoptions, if you would, because for some that seems like you're depriving people of privacy. It seems like you're going to introduce this level of complexity and difficult dynamics. Where are open adoptions these days?
Sure. First, it is the trend in adoption. So yeah. Whether we like them, dislike them, the research we've done, and not just on openness and adoption, also our latest research project has been on the internet's impact on adoption,
yeah.
A project called Untangling the Web. So I'll get to that bottom line first, and then I'm going to back up into your answering your question. Whether we like it or not, whether we feel good about it or bad about it, the reality is that as a result of the internet and adoption practice changes over the last, say, 20 years, 15 to 20 years, as a result of those things, and particularly the internet, the era of closed adoptions is pretty much coming to an end. You just can't assure anyone that they'll have anonymity for the rest of their lives. You just can't do it. In practice, it's done, you know, less and less because it doesn't serve the parties, however we may feel. And again, I'll get back to that. But in reality, whatever we think or might want, if somebody wants to find somebody, they're going to do it. The internet permits you to do that prospectively. And so good practice moving forward by agencies, by lawyers, by any professional is preparing parents and then children as they get older for the real possibility. It won't necessarily happen, but the real possibility that they will have something akin to an open adoption. And so to prepare for that and understand it and deal with it effectively and reap its benefits and try to diminish the complexity is a good thing to do because it's what's going to happen or is likely to happen in the modern age. As open adoption is a term that's very broadly used. For some people, it means the adoptive family and the birth mother usually, but the birth relatives are exchanging letters or maybe phone calls once a year and pictures. Mm-hmm. And the spectrum runs all the way from that to the babysitter on Friday nights is Jimmy's birth mother.
Right, right.
and that's for real.
Yeah.
And she's not really a babysitter, you know, she's taking care of the kid to whom she gave life. Yeah. It's hard for us, and it's hard mostly because I think, and I say this as an adoptive parent who certainly felt this way, because of the insecurities of adoptive parents. Mm-hmm. You know, if my son's birth family is going to, birth mother is around, you know, when he's 13, 14, 15 and rebelling, isn't he going to want to go to her? Well, the real answer is that at 14, 15, a kid doesn't want any parents, yeah. Not me, not her, not anybody. But, you know, kids learn the reality that we give them. Kids in divorced families and step families and all sorts of families learn the reality that it exists for them. And what we know from real long longitudinal studies and from a couple of generations or a good solid single generation and then some of open adoption is that it usually, not always, but nothing always works well, usually benefits all the parties, usually is better than the alternatives. And we know that the children aren't confused. They're not conflicted. They're not disloyal. You know, mommy and daddy are the people who put them to bed every day and send them to school and feed them. They know that. Mm-hmm. And then they know that there's someone else in their lives who they love and who loves them. It's okay. It's really the way I try to explain it is as an in-law model. You know, when you marry someone, they don't drop out of the sky. Yeah. They come with relatives. You may like them, dislike them. That's about forming relationships. And the adults in the situation can decide whether they want a relationship. But knowing them, understanding and respecting that they came from somewhere and from some people is a positive, generally speaking, not always, generally speaking. And that's what we've learned in this openness. I talk about openness because not every adoption is open, you know, in the ways I describe. But most adoptions today have openness around them, even adoptions from foster care, even adoptions from other countries. We talk more honestly with our children. We give them their backgrounds. We talk in a positive way about their origins. So there's much more openness about adoption, and there is a growth in what we call open adoptions.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Randy is with us in Salt Lake. Randy, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Doug, my wife and I have adopted a four-year-old, adopted at birth, and he's having some questions about, where do babies come from? And unbeknownst to him, we've kind of put the burden on him to ask about adoption. but I'm just wondering, you know, what's your perspective on, you know, at what age do you start talking about that? How much information do you give them? Don't want to overwhelm him by any means. but
right.
just interested on your take.
Yeah, great question.
I'd be delighted to answer the question. It's one of the most common I get. So I'll tell you, I'm going to give you two really quick stories to answer the question. One is a friend of mine, a social worker in Massachusetts, this a few years ago, was placing a baby, a newborn a few days old, in the arms of the new adoptive parents. And one of the parents leaned over to Ellen, my friend, and said, when do we tell her she's adopted? And so the first question is, why are these people whispering? You know, this is a three-day-old baby. And that tells us a little about how far we've come and how far we haven't come, right? And Ellen leaned back over and whispered, on the way home. And that is the advice I strongly give in any circumstance. It doesn't mean they'll understand what it means. They certainly won't at an early age. But it'll be a normal word. It'll be a normal thing that's part of the conversation in your home, not something you hid. Because otherwise, whatever other age you pick, I promise you, whether they say it or not, they're going to wonder why you didn't bring it up before. And they're going to wonder if it's something they did or something that's wrong. We keep secrets about things we're ashamed of and embarrassed about. That's what we keep secrets about. Everything else we talk about. And as for when and how much, this is an old joke. You know, little Julie goes up to her mother and asks her, where do I come from? And mom says, oh, God, I got to tell. It's time. And she gives her the whole thing, you know, the birds and the bees. And Julie looks up and says, thanks, Mommy. I wanted to know because my friend Mary says she comes from Kansas. You know, what you want to do is understand the questions that you're being asked. And you provide information in an age-appropriate way. You do that in a lot of ways about a lot of things. This is one of them. But this is one that should always be on the table in an honest way. And as little information as you want to give or as you think your child can receive when it's early, and then you follow their lead to some extent and you are the leader to the greatest extent in making sure they feel comfortable in their own skin. And part of their skin is adoption.
Randy, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join us. Back to the phones. Dana is with us in Ogden. Dana, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I think I'm calling more with a comment. I'm both an adoptive and a biological mom. And it's been our policy in our home. We have a very open conversation about our adoption and how it involves all of our kids. But one thing I'm really good at pointing out with our kids, and all of them, is the cop-out. And if for some reason you're feeling that you don't belong, we're quick to point out that everyone, universally, is going to have many times in their life where they don't fit in. They're not going to fit in with their friends. You're not going to fit in with your coworkers. You're not going to fit in with your parents. You're going to continue to feel this way. So as an adopted child, my kids don't get the cop-out card and say, I don't feel like I fit in because, oh, it must be because I'm adopted. No, you don't fit in because that's inherent to your human experience of growing and developing and figuring out who you are.
Yeah.
And I appreciated you saying, you know, every family is unique, but I just like that point. I think it's important to raise our kids to understand when you don't fit in, everyone feels that way.
Yeah.
And we all find, you know, we find our answers in our own uniqueness and in our own beauty and you know, in answers in unique ways, but hopefully in ways that are supported by your family.
Adam Pertman, you want to respond to that?
Well, I it's certainly true. I'll start with that. I think that the uniqueness of every individual derives from who they are. And that's all the more reason parents should understand where their kids come from. You know, if you give birth to a kid who has some unique traits, they may be very positive, they may be very negative, they may be neutral, but they're who that quirky kid is. You get to know about those traits. You get to know your child. You help them understand themselves. So it's not just children on their – I'm not disagreeing with the caller. It's not just the children, you know, sort of figuring out all this by themselves. It's parents leading them and making them, again, comfortable in their own skins.
Yeah.
And adoption is part of that makeup. It's not all of it. For some kids, it's tiny. For some, it's huge. Some kids, you know, I'll use a stark example. You know, there are adopted kids who are of color in white families, and, you know, the kid is 6'2", and his family is Eastern European 5'5". And, you know, that kid's got some differences that are stark and real and understandable. And, yes, you want to make them feel positive about those unique characteristics, but you have to understand them, and you have to help your kid connect with the positive parts. And that probably includes some role models for that kid who are African-American or who have some of the traits he has, so that he can look in the mirror and say, hey, that's pretty darn good. Because one thing that we have learned from the identity work that we've done, and we do an extensive amount of it, is that, and I actually tell two separate stories in my book that illustrate it, is that kids who don't grow up with role models, don't grow up with an understanding of who they are, and this was really stark in the days of when parents were, adoptive parents were told, just raise that child as if you gave birth to her. Well, there were a high number, and there still are in some transracial families, a high number of these kids who were well-adjusted, they did well, all the good stuff, and they hated looking in a mirror because they wanted someone white looking back, because that's who their community was. That's who their parents, the people they look up to and love, are. So, you know, and I don't think anybody on the face of it can think that's a really good thing in terms of self-esteem and identity and all that stuff. So yes, yes, yes to everything your caller said, but with a caveat, to raise those kids and to have them feel that, not use anything as an excuse, they have to understand themselves.
Mm. An email from Glenn, who writes, adoption has been the greatest experience for us. Our Isabel was the greatest, most perfect gift imaginable, he writes. I can't believe for one second that I could love a child more than I love this one. Which goes back to something, Adam Pertman, that you had talked about, is this question about whether or not biological parents love their biological kid. Let's say they have both. More like, is there a biological factor? You know what I mean? Because that seems.
I do.
That kind of seems obvious in an evolutionary way, that if you're tied to their genes, you're going to just inherently, whether you outwardly express it, you're going to just inherently have some more, some greater kind of connection in some way.
Well, you may have a different kind of connection. That's a different question than a different kind of love.
Yeah.
Can you love someone absolutely, purely, magnificently, to whom you're not genetically related? Let me introduce you to marriage. So I think you certainly can. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all, and I don't think it's a competition. I write in my book that I would have to grow a second heart to love my kids more.
Yeah.
And I feel that purely and absolutely. I think there's no rule here. I'm not going to be Pollyannish and say, oh, everybody's the same and everybody loves their kids exactly the same. Look, there are biological families where the parent will tell you in a quiet evening that they never say it to anyone, but they know themselves that they favor one of their kids over the other. It happens. But they don't love one kid more than the other. And there are lots of families in which, and this is, you know, again, telling real stories from real life, where I have had an adopted person come up to me and say, you know, my parents loved me. They took care of me. I feel blessed. It's all really, really good. But, you know, I have a sister who's biological to them, and I know they favored her. I know they loved her more. But I'm at peace with that. And then I talked to the sister, and she said, you know, I know my parents love me absolutely and purely, but, you know, they feel like they chose my adopted brother. And I know they favor him and kind of love him a little bit more. And you go, well, these both can't be true.
Right.
It's not a contest. They love their kids. And I think that embracing that and understanding it is just the raw starting point.
Thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Glenn, thank you very much for the email, radiowest@kuer.org. Adam Pertman directs the Donaldson Adoption Institute. You can find them online at adoptioninstitute.org. His book is called Adoption Nation, how the adoption revolution is transforming our families and America. And we need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about adoption with Adam Pertman. He's the executive director of the Donaldson Adoption Institute. It's a research and policy and education organization. He's joining us from a studio in Boston. His book is called Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming Our Families and America. And the book has been revised and updated not so long ago. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Teresa is with us in Salt Lake City. Teresa, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I was a birth mother in the early 90s, and it was a closed adoption. I never met the parents, but I realized at my young age that I was not prepared as a person to do that. And so I felt like I gave this incredible gift, and it was incredibly hard for me to couple that couldn't have children.
Yeah.
He's now 18, and I've received a letter from the parents, which is now, you know, they are allowed to do. And at the time, I told them they could get in touch with me if he ever had questions or anything like that. And I wrote very long letters to him about why I was doing, you know, how I made my choice. But I have not made contact with them, and I'm very nervous. They've invited me to meet him, but I worry about opening a wound, or maybe I'm wondering if I'm being selfish because it was such a painful, you know, thing to let him go, even though it was, I really feel it was the right thing to do,
yeah.
And it was a solid, positive choice, but it was still hurtful. I think I buried it a little bit.
Yeah.
And so my concern is meeting him and opening that back up. And my second thing is I do have children now of my own who are young, and they don't know my story.
Right.
And I don't know when it's appropriate to talk to them about that also.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a good question. Adam Perma, what do you think?
Well, that's not at all uncomplicated, is it? I'll tell you what I think, and then I think Teresa should do whatever she thinks is right.
Yeah.
For her. Because there are no singular answers that fit everybody. The biggest thing that I would suggest for Teresa is to find a support group, some other birth mothers who have gone through what she has gone through. Because, you know, you're living this, Teresa, in isolation. You have your example, and that's all you've got. There are other people. There are people who can give you support, wisdom, understanding, and I strongly suggest that it works well. I'm not talking about necessarily therapy here, just other people, other voices that are like yours to help you figure out your life. My two cents is that we teach our kids that honesty and openness are the right thing, and then we have to live with the consequences. And when we're not honest and we're not open, we also have to live with the consequences. So there are no decisions that don't have any. The research, and again, this is not saying what's right for any individual. The research is starkly clear that knowing that your kid is okay and that he or she has had a good life, et cetera, and very often contact, understanding those things in a real live way, is a healing factor, not a opening wound factor. It generally, at the first moment, you know, there will be some real complexity and maybe some real challenges. But over the long term, the research indicates that this is a positive for everybody concerned. It heals. You have you may or may not have a relationship. Those are things adults decide. But that knowledge, that contact, generally, over the life course, and for most women, is a positive. And I share that with you, and then you'll figure out what to do. In terms of other kids, again, because of the internet, because of lots of things, because son, who you placed, he may look for you. He may find his siblings. It may be out of your control. So you can do something that's in your control and figure out how to deal with it, how to tell them, how to how to do that in an age-appropriate way over time, etc. Or you can wait and see if you're surprised. I think enabling yourself emotionally, getting some real education about what works and what doesn't, talking to other people who have lived through situations such as yours would be of real benefit. And then you'll do what you think is right for your kids. But being afraid and hiding from it probably isn't the MO through which to get to the best possible result.
Teresa, good luck.
I can also just say one more thing.
Yep.
At the time when I did this, it was, you know, I was in love with this child, but at the same time, I was young. And for any women out there who are going through this, it was the biggest growth experience of my life. And it was a blessing in disguise. And I was able to do something that was bigger than me. And I just want to say that. That's all.
Glad you did. Thanks, Teresa.
Good
luck. 801-585-WEST again, the number to join us. Here's an email from Leanne who asks, what are the trends in terms of single-parent adoption? She says she wants to know the outcomes for kids from single adoptive homes. She writes that most research showing the outcomes for kids from single-parent families is on unwed mothers or women who are divorced. She writes, in my experience, women who choose to adopt on their own are educated, financially stable, and have cultivated a support network to help raise a happy, healthy child. So what do we know, Adam Pertman?
Well, we know that this gets into a whole nother chapter of how radically adoption has changed.
Yeah.
There, the direct answer to her question is that depending on how you're adopting, if you're that single woman adopting and you can't do this anymore or rarely can do it from abroad, but for 15 years, if you were a woman adopting from abroad, and certainly if you were or are adopting an infant, what she just described is probably accurate, you know, with the education, the money, because it costs real money to adopt from abroad or an infant domestically. So the networks, all that appears to be true. And the research isn't a lot of research on single parents adopting, but there is research that includes adopted kids, you know, and more broadly with single parenting. And the outcomes are good. The outcomes are positive. I'm rushing through this because we're running out of time. What I need to say is that most adoptions today, and this is a radical change from the past, most adoptions in America today are from foster care.
Yeah.
So by far. So we're not talking about infants generally. We're talking a disproportionate number of kids of color. We're talking about kids with special needs. We're talking about a lot of single women adopting, by the way,
mm-hmm.
but they're not the demographic that that this emailer described. More and more single black women adopting, and they're adopting older black kids. So, you know, this is a positive for those kids. But the demographics are really, really changing. So there's lots of single parent adoption, but most of it is not in the realm that that your caller or your emailer suggested. Most of it is in the realm of foster care, and it's a different story.
How do you, Madam Pertman, how has this changed American culture, this rethinking the idea of what family is?
Well, in some sort of real transparent ways and in some – and I think more – in the longer term, in much more subtle ways. And it's not just adoption by itself.
Sure.
You know, America's gone through a real cultural change in the last 50 years, and adoption is part of, is both a result of that change and an instigator and a grower of that change. That's not the right word, but, you know, it has contributed to that change.
Yeah.
The easy way to, I think, get at the enormity of it is that kids growing up today in just about any city, but there are probably exceptions, but in just about any city, know other children. First of all, they know other children of all sorts of families, but they know other kids, you know, they know Chinese girls in their class, sorry for the stereotyping, who have white parents.
Yeah.
They know kids of color of all colors with diverse parents. They know kids with two moms or two dads or one or going back to the single parent, all of those types of families include adoption, all of them. And so adoption while the number of adoptions is not, you know, enormous, though it, a lot more people are affected than they think they are, the impact is enormous because, you know, it was not a generation ago when people thought families looked a certain way.
Yeah.
And now it's modern family. Adoption has played a tremendous role in that for us adults already, and we're having all sorts of debates. But if you think about it in the longer term, kids growing up today will not have the same understanding of, you know, importance of bloodlines, what families look like, how they're formed, how they're supposed to function. And that is largely, not entirely, but largely a result of adoption.
There are efforts, and we don't have time, any time really, to talk about it in deep ways, but you are critical, for example, of organizations. I'll mention the LDS Church is one of them that tries to sort of keep this process a little bit closed. Are you seeing shifts in that way? People, you know, institutions, conservative institutions like churches, who are acknowledging that things are shifting or changing, or is there still a lot
Absolutely.
Of pushback?
There is pushback. I will say for the most part, I'm not stereotyping here because I honestly don't have a clue. I'll tell you when I know and tell you when I don't know.
Yeah.
But for the most part, what I see is that it's generational. And so as real life practice takes hold, even remember I said that most infant adoptions today, 95%, are open to some extent.
Yeah.
And only 5% are closed. Well, even in those 5% or the vast majority of that 5%, even that in that 5%, the pregnant woman chooses the new parents for her child. Well, that necessitates some level of openness, knowledge, contact that is different than anything there's ever been before. That, you know, a generation ago might have been called open adoption because she chose and not the agency chose. So this is a sea change, and that sea change is being both observed and practiced even by conservative organizations because it serves the parties better, A, and that's first and foremost, and B, we're running out of choices because the internet is going to make doing anything else nearly impossible.
Adam Pertman, his book is called Adoption Nation, How the Adoption Revolution is Transforming Our Families in America. He's executive director of the Donaldson Adoption Institute. You can find them online at adoptioninstitute.org. Adam Pertman, thanks very much for the time.
It was my pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.